permission to board that mothership, sir.
Well, you know, I had to slide through the intergalactic swag party.
DA, man, beam me up. What's going on, my brother from another mother? Beam me up.
You guys are the best.
You guys make it.
Permission to board that
mothership.
Hey, your ship has connected.
And you the man, DA.
America, the mothership has connected. Welcome aboard. It's the 4-hour satellite soiree. DA with you from the CBS Sports Radio studios in New York, broadcasting to affiliates nationwide and north of the border, Anchorage to Atlanta, Denver to Delray, Kalamazoo, and Waterloo. We are on the air.
They listening, DA. Everything we saying, DA. Everything.
How we doing, everybody? Thanks so much for joining us. It's a Trash Tuesday. Get to that coming up here momentarily. But the Denver Nuggets are world champions. Last night, closing out the Heat in five games. How about how that sounds? Denver Nuggets, NBA Finals champions. It's never been said ever before, and now Denver has the throne. We'll talk about it throughout the morning. Coming up here later on in the morning, Ian Thompson, longtime Sports Illustrated NBA senior writer, then NBA.com senior writer, author of Soul of Basketball. Ian will join us coming up in hour number four. We'll do trashes from you guys all morning long, right from Jump Street. You can send me whatever it is that's bugging you by tweeting at me, DA on CBS, or on the phones. Perhaps it's about the NBA postseason, or the NBA season in general, or the NBA Finals at 877-855-212-4227 is the phone number. Coming up this hour on the show, sound check in 20 minutes. In 40 minutes, Bill Belichick puts a curious name in the group of all-timers he has coached. And as I mentioned before, we'll get to our trashes next hour here on the show. But let's begin in Denver last night, where the Nuggets closed things out. It was a game where the Heat really led for big chunks of the game in the first half. In fact, the Nuggets really played poorly, and Bam Adebayo nearly had a 20-10 double-double in the first half alone. But when it came down to the fourth quarter in crunch time, the Heat fizzled, especially outside of Jimmy Butler. They just could not create any offense, and the Nuggets' depth showed. That, plus the Joker did what the Joker does. So what was the most crucial part of a Nuggets title? It is where we begin. You're cold open.
Gordon, kick out three over to Bruce. He puts it on the floor. Back to Gordon. Left side, Murray to three.
It's just an amazing feeling, you know. I blood, sweat, and tears to get back to this point. Everybody, my team in here, everybody on the floor, believe in me to get back to myself. And you know, we proved a lot of doubters wrong.
Five on the clock for Miami, guarded by Aaron Gordon. Lowry, blocked by Gordon. He made him eat it.
This is what I really envisioned a few years ago when we got Aaron Gordon. And you know, sometimes a dream is deferred, and our dream was deferred for a few years, but we stuck with it. And we added the right pieces. Huge shout out to Calvin Booth and the job that he's done. And yeah, this is just an unbelievable feeling.
8 seconds left to go. Casey's across the timeline, and he'll dribble it out. The 47-year wait is over. The Denver Nuggets stand on top of the NBA world.
It's a good feeling when you know that you did something that nobody believes, and just it was just us. It's just the organization of Denver Nuggets believe in us. Every player believe in each other, and I think that's the most important thing.
I don't believe it!
The most amazing, sensational, dramatic, heartrending.
It's DA's top story.
Here he goes!
It's your cold open.
Okay, you heard there, Nuggets radio on the calls, and that was Jamal Murray, as well as Michael Malone, the head coach, and Nikola Jokic. The most crucial part about the Nuggets championship run is clearly Jokic. And this stat really blew my mind. In fact, I had to pause the TV, and when they passed through that graphic, rewind it during the postgame and make sure I got it right. That in this postseason, the most points were scored by Nikola Jokic. In this NBA postseason, the most rebounds were tallied by Nikola Jokic. And in this NBA playoff, start to finish, the most assists were dished out by Nikola Jokic. That's the first time that it ever happened in NBA playoffs history that the same guy in the postseason led points, rebounds, assists. His sustained brilliance was the differential throughout every single one of their series. Jokic never had an off night. Jokic never had a bad night. And Jokic never shrunk when it mattered most. He punched early in a series. He punched late in a series. He punched early in a game of a series. He punched late in a game of a series. He punched in the first quarter, in the third quarter, in crunch time, when they had a blowout lead, when they were losing. It didn't matter. He was the metronome. Every single game was the same. Tick, tock, tick, tock, tick, tock. And you cannot put a price tag or a value on something like that for a champion. Kobe Bryant once said, to be great, you must first be predictable. And then you work on that to become unpredictable. And what he meant by that is, your teammates need to know what to expect from you. Your coaches need to know what to expect from you. So before you can become great, you must become predictable. You must do the same things every day, every night, so that those around you fit into that. And then you can add layers and unpredictability, multiplicity to your game. But first, you must have a foundation where you approach everything the same way, and your production is what follows. And that was Jokic. We will discuss this more in depth as we make our way through the morning, but Nikola Jokic now is the king of the NBA. And it's interesting because I don't think a lot of people before this postseason would point to Jokic and say, oh yeah, no doubt he's the best player in the league. But now, it'd be hard to make the argument he's not the best player in the league. So that's the first biggest part about the Nuggets winning a championship. The second part was something that Michael Malone cited there, and that was the depth of this team, where smart moves, smart maneuvers were made with a vision in mind, and one of those was Aaron Gordon. In this NBA Finals, Jokic led the team in scoring three times, including last night. Jamal Murray led the team in scoring one of those games, game three. And then Aaron Gordon led in scoring in game four. Now, they all led those tallies total in the game, both Heat and Nuggets. But it goes to show you, they didn't have one great scorer throughout this postseason. Jokic, obviously, and Jamal Murray carried most of the water. But you had a night for Gordon in the NBA Finals. You had a night for Michael Porter Jr. back in the first round, where he led the game in scoring. You had a number of games in the conference finals where it was Jamal Murray's show, back-to-back 37-point efforts in Game 2 and Game 3. Add to that some of the dirty work, some of the little stuff that was done by Christian Brown as we made our way through this series. As we saw some of the guys on the interior grab some rebounds that maybe didn't have to go to Jokic each and every time. We saw Kentavious Caldwell-Pope actually hit a big three-pointer last night. We saw Bruce Brown, huge in crunch time for the Nuggets last night. We saw DeAndre Jordan get in, of all people. DeAndre Jordan, who even knew he was on the Nuggets? So the Nuggets around Jokic and Jamal Murray were able to apply pieces and depth throughout this, and it finally came together this year. And I think the other thing that the Nuggets kind of always had in their back pocket was the knowledge of who they were, and that was a team that could score and could run and could hit you with waves of offense and didn't always have to be great defensively. Last night, they weren't. Last night, yet again, the Nuggets didn't have to be great defensively. Their opponent shot themselves out of the game. I mean, the Heat last night were woeful from three, 9 of 35. And so the Nuggets didn't have a great game last night. But they also didn't get rattled. They also didn't end up going, uh-oh, what is going on? We're going to gag this. And that comes back to Jokic's demeanor. Jokic's demeanor allowed them to always play at a certain temperature. Jamal Murray's kind of like that as well. And maybe it has to do with both of them not being American. You know, sometimes internationally born players just don't have that din of excitement, that fire sometimes that American-born players do. Jamal Murray's Canadian, so he's not far, but still, he was a guy that was much more and is much more even-tempered than your traditional NBA star. And I just think they took on that DNA throughout this run. And we all know, I said from the outset of the postseason, I don't trust the Nuggets. They're going to falter. They're going to be exposed to the Western Conference Finals or exposed to the NBA Finals. And they never were. I was dead wrong on this. I thought their defensive lapses would come back to haunt them. I had nothing against Nikola Jokic. I knew how great he was. I had nothing against Jamal Murray. It was obvious how well they played off one another. I had nothing against the offense that they had. They could come at you in waves. I just thought you have to get crucial stops on defense when it matters in the NBA playoffs, and that without them, you know, they were going to get sunk. They never faced a team where that part of their character really haunted them. They just never faced it. They got to the second round of the NBA playoffs, and, you know, they could really run and gun and outscore the Suns. They won a couple of those games in high-scoring fashion, so they were able to kind of capitalize on that. The Suns could play good offense, but so could they. You know, the two games that they lost in that series, they gave up 120 points. They gave up 121 in Game 3 and 129 in Game 4. And then, you know, they were kind of able to flip the script, and they were able to be the ones that scored the big numbers. Game 5 of that series, they scored 118. Game 6, they scored 125, and they didn't have close games there. They blew out the Suns. So they were able to use their offense as a hammer over the head. Against the Lakers, they just didn't play a team that could possibly keep up with them on offense. And they made enough shots, and they really couldn't be slowed down. And in that series, they scored 132, 119, 113. And then in this series, five games, the Heat cracked 100 points once. They scored in the 90s four other times. In fact, less than they scored in the 80s. Are you going to say that's good defense? I didn't see it that way. I didn't feel as though in this NBA Finals, the Nuggets got great defense. It was that a limited Heat team had an average Jimmy Butler, and they needed a superhuman Jimmy Butler every night, and then their role players to hit big threes. And they didn't. Last night, they hit 9 threes the entire night, and it sunk them. So this is not to take away from the Nuggets, because that's a great championship run. They'll always have the ring. The ring is the thing. They get the banner. They get the parade, and that's awesome. But what I thought was going to do them in, didn't do them in. Their defensive lapses didn't do them in because they were so good offensively. So good. And last night, even them from three, the Nuggets, they shot 5 of 28, 18% from beyond the arc. Had the Nuggets not taken a three-pointer, their twos, they shot at nearly 60%. So all of their damage was done to that little mid-range stuff from Jamal Murray, the underneath stuff from Nikola Jokic, and they were kind of able to just make their offense that way. credit to the Nuggets. I always think it's great when a long-suffering franchise and fan base gets to break a drought, and they did. The Nuggets have never tasted a victory in a championship, and so they finally got one, and that's really cool. Kudos to the Nuggets. More on the NBA Finals throughout the morning at 855-212-4CBS and on Twitter, DA on CBS. When we come back, we've got Soundcheck, your best audio of the day, so stay right there. Soundcheck features a Charles Barkley hockey highlight, and Maggie Gray yesterday had to take one on the chin. She had to, by losing a bet, eat an entire jar of jelly. How did that go? You'll hear next. DA, CBS Sports Radio.
CBS presents this program in color.
An educated person can't think he's going to get a recruit by strippers coming in.
They can fire you, but they can't eat you.
And they run through our ass like through a tin horn, man, and we could not stop them.
The audio you need to hear. It's DA Soundcheck.
All right. Welcome back and a happy Tuesday to you, everybody. Thanks so much for joining us. You can always listen to the show in podcast form. The full 4 hours with the best of the show available for your listening pleasure. Just search the DA Show on your favorite podcast platform. Subscribe, rate, and review. Soundcheck begins with Charles Barkley, who says that Golden Knight star Jack Eichel, on the verge of his own championship, doesn't know who Barkley was. Here's Chuck.
So yesterday I was at the hotel. I walked up to Jack Eichel and said how great he was. I think he had zero idea who I was. I did. He was at the hotel. We sat in the same hotel. I said, hey, Mr. Eichel, it's an honor. You're a great player. But he looked at me like, who the hell are you? It was pretty funny.
Is it possible Barkley knows who Jack Eichel is, but Jack Eichel doesn't know who Barkley is?
I guess it is possible, but that would seem extreme. Barkley's not just a basketball guy. He's, for lack of a better term, a pop culture phenomenon. He's in a ton of commercials.
Yeah, exactly. And what are the odds that that's the role here? That the hockey guy doesn't know the basketball guy, but the basketball guy knows the hockey guy?
Right.
But I suppose this is a good example of this is true. Maybe Eichel was just being overly polite and it seemed like he didn't know who he was. But this is an example of how hockey guys sometimes live in their own bubble, live in their own world, that hockey guys only know hockey. That sometimes happens. I don't know. I've interviewed hockey players or, you know, been around hockey locker rooms occasionally. And you just, and hockey people, they just have this snow globe around them. Yeah. And they don't know what happens outside of their sport. And like, is it possible Eichel could tell you every player in every roster of the NHL, but just like, is like me, hasn't watched a movie in 35 years?
Well, not only that, he is 26. He is U.S. born. But born in 96, he's essentially born after Barkley's played, after Space Jam has come out. And then, you know, these hockey players coming up, they play a lot of travel. There's not a lot of time for TV movies. Maybe it's true. Maybe he is in his own world and he pays zero attention to that.
Him being an American-born, though, hockey player, that is surprising. You can convince me that a Canadian-born hockey player doesn't know who Barkley is. An American-born hockey player? He grew up just outside of Boston. I mean, that's a big sports town for everything. Like, it'd be surprising to me if he didn't know most of the Celtics players.
But think about it. By the time he's six, when he's really into, like, watching sports, maybe it's 2002, D.A.
But Charles Barkley is beyond his playing days. A lot of people don't remember him there, but still know who Barkley is. Just because, as you said, he's in commercials. He's kind of ubiquitous on television and in pop culture.
But, and again, I don't know this because my parents failed me, but it feels like if you're an ice hockey player growing up, you're on the road and playing so many late nights, even as a kid and stuff, all this ice time, I don't think you're watching much NBA. Broadcasts and the commercials that you would see him in.
This would be surprising. I'd be surprised that anybody in sports, there are some people that don't know who Barkley is, but some people in sports that don't know who Barkley is, that would be shocking to me. Here's Maggie Gray. Now, coming off of Andrew Perloff losing a bet and having to eat the entire jar of peanut butter a couple of months ago, Maggie Gray is going to eat an entire jar of jelly on air. This was yesterday on the Maggie and Perloff show.
Oh boy, there's a lot of jelly left. I thought she was making progress. There's a lot of jelly left.
See, I told you. These are fake lifelines that you are giving me.
I think this is going to end up worse than the peanut butter challenge, and I was sick for 4 days.
Oh no.
I'm like, my hands are shaking.
No, this is going.
This is all the sugar.
This is going terribly awry.
Maggie's not sleeping for at least 48 hours.
Do you want to take a small break and then maybe we assess your vitals?
I kind of want to just drink a little water and maybe stand up. Why don't maybe just start running out of the office.
Honestly. Well, real talk here,
that was just
real talk
a really
here.
Big bite there.
Can we get some makeup? You look green.
Please don't tell me. I need makeup.
So Maggie finishes the final scoop of jelly. And she kind of chokes it down and then puts both her hands on her head and slumps back into her chair. It is pretty gross to do an entire jar of jelly. I can't decide which is grosser, the jar of jelly or the jar of peanut butter all in one sitting.
Oh, I think it's the jelly.
It's probably the jelly because the jelly has a weird consistency to sit in your stomach, all of that jelly, and there's all of that sugar, where at least peanut butter maybe it's a more stable binding effect in your stomach. Oof. It's a lot, though, of peanut butter.
No,
but
I disagree.
I think I might get a sugar headache as well from a jar of jelly.
Well, you could eat peanut butter you could eat just the peanut butter sandwich. You're not eating just the jelly sandwich. You could do, like, jelly with butter on toast. I think jelly is not enough of a standalone item to eat a whole jar of on its own.
Yeah, it's kind of like it would be hard to eat an entire container of ketchup.
Hell kind of yeah.
That sounds gross. Anything that you can't bite or crunch into sounds absolutely disgusting. And that's probably why she struggled so much.
But peanut butter is so heavy. And
but at least there's peanuts in it.
But not if you're, but that's if you pick crunchy.
Oh, why would you pick creamy?
Maybe you're a gentleman. You pick creamy. I don't know. I'd rather try the jelly, without a doubt. Peanut butter, I feel like, just becomes one big clump in your gut. No thanks.
Really, Bogues? You think you could do an entire jar of jelly?
When I first heard of this yesterday, or I guess it was Sunday when Maggie was tweeting about her fears for yesterday's show, I love jelly. I almost wanted to try this along with her. Now, watching her live it has changed my thoughts a little bit, but I still think she had the easier task head-to-head than Perloff.
Wow, I'm surprised to hear you say that. But you do have a bit of a sweet tooth. You do you do like your sweets. Huh. Was this a bet lost, or do I have this wrong? They just did this challenge.
No, she asked if we hit a certain number of new YouTube subscribers, I'll do this. And they got there.
Wow. Right. So when does Stu eat the whole bottle of marshmallow fluff?
Next sweeps. When is that? September?
Yeah. Okay.
Sounds like you're a little annoyed at another show doing eating challenges.
Look, I thought the peanut butter thing was very cool. But, you know, I and this show, we're the food challenge show. It is what it is. And Maggie, I consider a personal friend. I can't help but think that she's channeling the DA show every turn. You know, we already did the peanut butter. I think we could have done something in the jelly. And then doing spicy chicken nuggets. And let's leave the food to us. Can we have a little steak to something here?
You said right off the bat, the peanut butter challenge was, and then you cut off. Did you like the peanut butter challenge that they did?
No, I said I thought the peanut butter challenge was all right. But I'm just going to say, I think you start to kill the bit a little bit now when you go to the jelly. And then it's like, you know, you do one food thing. We're the show that does 50 food things. Let us be that show. Not every show needs to do 50 food things because then it waters down our product.
So you want everybody to stand back on food tastings and food challenges and let us have the territory.
Yes. Can we have a flag planted that's just ours, please? We perfected this thing. Let us be us. I mean, we don't know what Badland's going to put in his mouth on Friday. All right. That's a big deal.
And do you think that by virtue of the peanut butter challenge and now the jelly challenge, it has made whatever Badland's does on Friday less effective?
Yes. You know what? No. It makes her jelly thing less effective because the whole network is anticipating what Badland's going to put in his mouth and slapping me with a kielbasa. Now, you know what? He's going to lose some of the jelly buzz. Now, they did a good job getting it in on Monday as opposed to waiting until Friday. But no, I think what Badland's does is still going to be a bigger deal. Come on. Let us be the food people.
I feel bad for Maggie because she's petite, and thinking about an entire jar of jelly in her stomach
now,
is really gross.
I witnessed her on another radio station working with her eat an entire large New York City pizza to herself, so I knew she could handle this eventually.
Okay.
But she could eat. Maggie absolutely can eat. And I'm always envious of the really thin people that can eat like that, because then it's like, how did I go wrong?
Well, because she does it once every 18 months.
And you're saying I do it every day?
Not every day, but I would think your day-to-day eating is where the difference is.
More frequent.
Yeah.
All right. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Finally, clip number three in Soundcheck. Here is the local side of things, WFAN, veteran sportscaster Joe Beningo gets to meet on air his producer for the day, or maybe the update anchor for the day, in fact, during his shift, and that would be Jack Stern. Here's the clip.
On the other side of the glass, all right, our update guy, Jack Stern, okay? I don't think have I met you, Jack?
I don't think you would recognize me if you saw me.
Yeah, probably not. You telling me now that you're a Yankee fan and a Philly fan, can you please explain? Because to me, that's impossible. Can you please explain how that is?
Right. So I try not to talk about this too much here at the station because, you know, I don't want people looking at me.
Because it's really impossible. But go ahead.
Yeah, so my dad is from Philadelphia. He grew up a big Phillies fan.
Okay.
And just being around him as a little kid.
Is he still a Phillies fan, your father?
He's a diehard Phillies fan. He actually lives in France for half the year, and he still watches every single game.
He lives in France, and he's still – okay.
Yeah, and we text back and forth between the games, believe it or not, too.
Okay.
And he's a diehard Phillies fan. Then I also went to games at Shea Stadium. I was really turned back by some of the Mets fans who were kind of – hostile toward me and my father at a very young age, you know, throwing napkins at us when I was wearing a Rollins jersey.
There's more?
Well, it just went, I droned on and on. I thought I got the important stuff in there.
But how did we get to the Yankee fandom part?
The Yankee fandom was another 6 minutes down the line, and that's how it got there. He couldn't be a Met fan because they were throwing napkins at him when he showed up to Met Philly games as a kid.
But why didn't he just adopt the Phillies?
Because he moved to New York, and he wanted to be one with the city and have a New York team.
Fraud.
So he's both a Phillies and a Yankees fan.
Fraud.
I'm sorry. I couldn't let a three-minute Jack Stern clip play in Soundcheck. That was a minute already.
Beningo wasn't having it.
No, he doesn't like that stuff. But the important stuff is Jack Stern at a young age, we find out, is shaped by the idea that napkins were thrown at him by Mets fans. And we got the caveat when Carlos told us, he admits on air his father lives in France six months out of the year.
Validation. This is the key. This is the key.
Bogues, why is this the key?
We need more investigation. We need the Jack Stern origin story. Dee, I don't know if you've been brought up to speed on all of the Jack issues and things that popped up while you were gone, but there's a lot more on the table now, and we need to know how we got here. And that's a huge clue that Jack's dad lives 6 months of every year in France. Doing what? Who's he with? Who's watching Jack? These are all
watching him. He's an adult.
It's a clue to what? What's that a clue to?
There's theories as to why Jack is Jack, and this falls in line with at least one theory that Jack comes from a lot of money, well-to-do.
Entitlement.
Entitled. Never, you know, he's not a blue-collar guy.
Nobody checking him and his attitude at home.
You guys don't know that. He could be Batman.
He could be Batman. Well, that's another theory. Hence, furthers my point. We need to know what's going on.
I mean, he goes home and lives in a very nice home without having to worry about his parents because they're in France, and he thinks he's an accomplished adult at 23 years old, and that explains a lot of his attitude around here.
Oh, man.
I thought that was an important clip. I think Bogus should agree to share.
Yeah.
An important clip.
Well, you know, he's become a storyline. We piece together his life. That's important. And we also find out he's a fraud. He turns his back or wants to adopt it because he comes up here, adopts the Yankees because Met fans threw, by the way, of all the things to throw at him, napkins? Oh, man, please don't throw napkins at me.
Right, napkins are the things you throw at me after you threw the condiments.
Or the hard stuff that
right.
actually left a lump on my head.
Can you picture him whining in the backseat of his dad's convertible back to Philly because, oh, I got pelted with a napkin.
Or he has Jeeves driving them home to the brownstone.
Wow. Yeah, I think in that case, I would have just been a Phillies fan. I don't think I would have had to adopt
right.
a New York team or of course a team not. In a new city.
Like when Sean goes to Tucson, he's not going to become a Diamondbacks fan. Right. He's going to stay a Yankee fan.
Of course. Yeah, you worked at Boston. You're not a Red Sox fan. You may not hate them, but you're not a fan.
No, in fact, everywhere that I went, I tried to be as transparent as possible because I didn't want to come off as a phony. That was my biggest fear, that everywhere that I moved for a job, I would come off as a phony if I quote unquote adopted their teams. So I tried to go the other way. Yeah, I think Jack would have been fine being a Phillies fan in New York. I don't think he would have been somehow ostracized socially.
Now, would you guys have all been scarred, by the way, if you went to a game with your father and opposing fans threw napkins at you? I feel like my kid would laugh.
Well, any of your kin would be like, moo. Yes, the plan is working perfectly. They hate me, father. They hate me.
I also need to know, you can't really throw a napkin. You can drop a napkin at somebody.
No. Right, you have to fold it to a paper plane or something and toss it.
That doesn't have a lot of heft behind it.
But that's the point. He's complaining that something that didn't have heft on him hit him.
Or you got to get pretty close to land it.
Oh.
It's the least offensive physical attack you could probably take.
It's true. I mean, also, if you start with the block that my family's from Philly, I would think that you are used to being abused and doing the abuse. It's kind of like par for the course. Like, if we're Philly fans, nothing can hurt us because we will abuse you and you will abuse me, and we've got the scars to prove it.
Is there a happier fan base than Philadelphia that the Stearns moved to Brooklyn? They don't want to claim them. They don't want to claim the Stearns. We used to work with Kenny Brock. Could you imagine him at a sit next to Jack Stone saying, that's the same fan base I am?
No. No, Brock would not take kindly to that truth. He would not take kindly to that. Yeah, I would think that if your dad's from Philly, he's like, hey, son, we're going to go to Shea. It's going to get ugly. You wear your Rollins jersey, that's fine, but expect the abuse. And we take it because we're from Philly. You know, that's I would imagine, instead of shielding him from the napkins that might be raining down. And also, you think that New Yorkers are ruthless. Okay, yes, we could be. But I don't think there's many New Yorkers really abusing children in Jimmy Rollins jerseys.
Right.
It's probably like one other kid that happened to throw maybe a napkin. I mean, it's not like adults sit around Philly fans that are children in the stands and pound them physically.
I'm assuming when you have Stern money, they were sitting in box seats, or it was just a windy day at Shea, and from the loge, a napkin got loose and fluttered down and hit him in the head.
They hate me, Daddy. They hate me.
Do you have any gray poupon?
Why are the employees throwing napkins at us?
All right, that is sound check. Standing by, kind sir, with our headline this morning as the Nuggets clinch a world championship is Andrew Bogut.
And it's all sponsored by Progressive Insurance. Looking for a career path with flexibility and great pay and benefits? Go to progressive.com/careers and apply online today. The Heat finally found a superior team it could not upset, bowing out to the Nuggets in Game 5, 94-89 in Denver last night. Heads high, though, says Eric Spoelstra.
They're a class act, and they're one hell of a basketball team. One hell of a basketball team. And we couldn't really find, obviously, enough solutions to be able to get us over the top.
Miami did lead for good chunks of Game 5, including a one-point edge with just under two to go, but there was a Bruce Brown go-ahead hoop, some Nugget free throws, and some Heat turnovers, and Denver won by five. It's their first NBA title in 47 years in the league. And not surprisingly, Nikola Jokic won the Bill Russell Award as Finals MVP after 28 points, 16 boards, and 4 assists. Bam Adebayo on dealing with Jokic.
He just makes the right play every possession. I feel like that's the biggest thing about, you know, the player that he is. He's going to try and make the right play every possession, no matter if it's scoring the ball, passing it, getting a hockey assist. It doesn't matter. I feel like that's what makes him dynamic.
Jokic is
That's a good way to put it, actually, right? That's kind of the perfect encapsulation of what makes Jokic is great. He's so consistent. He just makes the right play every single possession, which is really hard to defend for 48 minutes.
Jokic is the first player ever to lead the postseason in points, rebounds, and assists, and he is the lowest draft pick, number 41, to ever win Finals MVP.
Wow, that's a good factoid. I wonder how many second rounders ever have been Finals MVP.
I know that too. Only three, but it gets a little skewed because at times, like pick 28 was in the second round, which it's not now. So I think this is a little more telling. He was the 41st player picked, lowest ever to win Finals MVP.
And there used to be more rounds of the NBA draft
as well. True, right, correct.
And what we're seeing is no undrafted player has ever won the Finals MVP. So that's kind of surprising.
I don't know if that's true or not.
Oh.
This is the lowest draft pick.
Okay.
So that's a specific thing. He's the lowest drafted player to win MVP. I don't know if that means there's an undrafted MVP. There might be, but this sentence doesn't eliminate that possibility.
Was Ginobili a second rounder?
He's not on the list of second round picks that I saw, so he might be undrafted.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have the other list of the second rounders?
I don't have the names in front of me. One of them is Dennis Johnson. I don't remember who the other. The other one might have been a center whose name I should remember, but I don't right now, but I can get that for you.
Okay.
Away from the finals, Fred VanVleet's reportedly declining his $22 million option for next season, so he'll be a free agent, or the Raptors could work out a sign and trade with somebody, or VanVleet's apparently open to signing a fresh deal in Toronto. Condolences to Peter Schwartz, who just stuck his head in the studio. His Long Island Ducks have lost Daniel Murphy, the former Mets second baseman, signing a minor league deal with the Angels, continuing his comeback that no one really asked for. At the moment, though, those Angels don't need much help.
First pitch on Shohei, lifts one high, hits it deep out into left field, and that ball is gone. Shohei Ohtani has hit his second home run of the night. A two-run shot to start off the 12th inning.
That's Terry Smith on Angels Radio. Ohtani with the seemingly impossible leadoff two-run homer, helping the Halos get a 9-6 win in 12 in Texas. Those two homers last night. Ohtani now leads the AL with 20. The A's stayed hot, 4-3 over the Rays. That's a six-game run for them. The Mariners stumped the Marlins 8-1. The Tigers surprised the Braves 6-5-10. And the Phillies lost in Arizona 9-8 despite JT Realmuto hitting for the cycle. College baseball, Stanford and Tennessee claim the final spots in Omaha by beating Texas and Southern Miss. And the Patriots released former Jags and Jets running back James Robinson yesterday, 3 months after signing him. The deal had no guaranteed money, so there's no financial penalty for the Pats. DA, back to you.
Remember when Tony Khan came on the show and bragged about how he found James Robinson? Now James Robinson can't get a job. By the way, this portion of the show, including Soundcheck, brought to you by Wesley Financial. Stuck in a timeshare? Want out? Contact Wesley Financial Group now and get a free timeshare exit information kit at wesleyfinancialgroup.com. When we come back here on the show, Bill Belichick had a curious name that he included in his all-time great players that he's coached. We'll give you that name next. DA, CBS Sports Radio. Bill Belichick is coached of the best players ever. Lawrence Taylor comes to mind. Tom Brady comes to mind. But how about this third name that he throws in there? Here's Bill.
You know, I feel like coach the best offensive player, best player in football in Tom, the best defensive player in football in LT, and the best special teams player in football in Matt Slater. And, you know, when you have the opportunity to coach players that are they're great in areas, not and that, of course, includes the specialists, you know, guys like Anna Vinatieri and Goskowski, and you don't want to take anything away from them either. But, you know, and great punters like Landetta and Jennings and so forth. But, you know, the special teams coverage guys, and we've had a lot of them back in the Giants, you know, with Renee Thompson and you know, great returners like Megat and Edelman and Troy Brown and all that. But, you know, as a core special teams player, Slater really is, you know, I'd say, you know, been the best of all time. And, you know, I hope he gets recognized for that. But, you know, if you're a coach and you can coach Taylor, Brady, and Slater, that's three pretty good players.
That's Bill Belichick speaking to Mike Tannenbaum on the 33rd team. That's a multi-part series from Tannenbaum. So, look, goodbye Tannenbaum to get the sit-down with Belichick. I guess they're tight. I guess they're friends. And I don't blame Belichick or any coach for going to bat for his guys. This has happened since the dawn of time. Coaches have tried to get their players into the Hall of Fame or be recognized as all pros or Pro Bowls, just get that recognition. You could understand that. Players going to bat and doing battle for you. You are the winning coach. You want those guys to be recognized, certainly if you think that they're being ignored. But this made waves simply because it seems so outlandish to put Matthew Slater in the same conversation with truly perhaps two of the five greatest football players ever. I mean, Tom Brady, Lawrence Taylor, Jim Brown, Jerry Rice, that's kind of like your four greatest football players of all time. So you're not putting Matthew Slater in that conversation. Also, as good as Slater has been, and he's been very good, there's no doubt this generation, he's been the most consistent, dependable, smart, locker room leader, special teams guy in the NFL. Still, Steve Tasker's a better gunner. Tasker was and still is. He is the statue to which gunners bow to. So is Matthew Slater a really good special teams player? Absolutely. Is he the best of this generation? Absolutely. But he's not even the best special teams player ever. So for Belichick to say that, I mean, maybe he's not saying Slater's the greatest of all time on special teams, but he is kind of lumping him in. I've coached a lot of good players, and Slater's one of them. That's fine. But if we're talking about Halls of Fame, which none of these guys are in, you can't put him in before you put Tasker in. And I would just slow the roll a little bit of putting Matthew Slater in a conversation, the same breath as LT and Brady, because there are those two guys, and then there is a pretty dramatic drop-off before we get to Matthew Slater. Wouldn't you say, Mraz?
Yeah, I think it's pretty freaking embarrassing to include Matthew Slater gunning on special teams in the same breath of anybody. I mean, it's honestly embarrassing to include him in the same breath as Matt Ryan, who's a debatable Hall of Famer at the quarterback position.
It's embarrassing to put Matthew Slater with Matt Ryan.
Yeah, like that's how big a drop-off it is. I'm sorry, you're a special teams gunner. You have a unique set of skills. You're not Liam Neeson. You don't deserve to be in the same breath as anybody who's even a fringe Hall of Famer at a real position.
It's also a little hard to decipher what's real and what's not with his accolades because he's been to 10 Pro Bowls.
Right.
But, you know, there's plenty of players that are greater than him that didn't make as many Pro Bowls.
And if he was a Jaguar special teamer, would he have gone to 10 Pro Bowls?
No chance. No, no chance. When we come back, the Nuggets are champions. We'll talk about Stan Kroenke's ridiculous run next.